In a certain town in England, which I shan't name, there's a public building common to most towns, namely a workhouse. And in this workhouse was born the item of mortality whose name is also the name of this story. For a long time after he was ushered by the parish surgeon into this world of sorrow, it remained a matter of considerable doubt whether the child would survive to bear any name at all. Oliver lay gasping on a little flock mattress, poised between this world and the next, the balance being decidedly in favour of the latter. However, finally Oliver breathed and proceeded to advertise to the inmates of the workhouse that a new burden had been imposed upon the parish. As Oliver gave this first proof of the proper action of his lungs, the pale face of a young female was raised feebly from the pillow. "Let me see the child and die." The surgeon, who'd been sitting before the fire, rose and went to the bed. "Oh, you mustn't talk about dying yet." "Lord bless her dear heart, no," interposed the nurse, hastily depositing in her pocket a green glass bottle, the contents of which she'd been tasting in a corner with evident satisfaction. The patient shook her head and stretched out her hand towards the child. The surgeon placed it in her arms. She imprinted her cold white lips on its forehead, fell back, and died. The surgeon put on his hat and paused by the bed on his way to the door. "She was a good-looking girl. Where did she come from?" "Brought here last night," replied the old woman. "Found lying in the street. Where she came from, nobody knows." The surgeon leant over the body and raised the left hand. "No wedding ring, I see. The old story. Well, good night." The parish authorities resolved that Oliver should be dispatched to a branch workhouse some 3 miles off, where 20 or 30 other juvenile offenders against the poor laws rolled about the floor all day. The elderly female who ruled this roost received 7d/halfpenny per head per week, enough for a good round diet for a child. However, the elderly female appropriated the greater part of the weekly stipend to her own use. It cannot be expected that this system would produce any very luxuriant crop. Oliver Twist's 9th birthday found him a pale and thin child, somewhat diminutive in stature. He was keeping his birthday in the coal cellar with 2 other young gentlemen who, after participating with him in a sound thrashing, had been locked up for presuming to be hungry. Above them, Mrs. Mann, the good lady of the house, was startled by the apparition of Mr. Bumble, the beadle, striving to undo the garden gate. She thrust her head out of the window in well-affected ecstasies of joy. "Goodness gracious, is that you, Mr. Bumble, sir? Susan, take Oliver and them 2 brats upstairs and wash 'em directly. How glad I am to see you." She came running out, unbolted the gate and ushered the beadle into a small parlour. Mr. Bumble took out a leathern notebook. "To business. The child, Oliver Twist, is 9 years old today." "Bless him," interposed Mrs. Mann, inflaming her left eye with the corner of her apron. "And notwithstanding an offered reward of £10, we have never been able to discover who is his father or his mother's name or condition." "How comes he to have any name at all, then?" said Mrs. Mann. The beadle drew himself up. "I invented it. We name our foundlings in alphabetical order. The last was S, Swabble, I named him. This was a T, Twist. The next one as comes will be Unwin. I've got names ready made to the end of the alphabet."
"Why, you're quite a literary character, sir," said Mrs. Mann.
Well, said the beadle, evidently gratified with the compliment. "Now, Oliver, being too old to remain here, the board have determined to have him back into the main house, and I have come out myself to take him there. Let me see him at once." And so Oliver was led away by Mr. Bumble from the wretched home where one kind word or look had never lighted the gloom of his infant years. He arrived at the workhouse at a moment when the regime had just been adjusted by the board to provide 3 meals of thin gruel a day, with an onion twice a week and half a roll on Sundays. The room in which the boys were fed was a large stone hall, with a copper at one end, out of which the master, dressed in an apron for the purpose, assisted by 1 or 2 women, ladled the gruel at mealtimes. Boys have generally excellent appetites.
Oliver Twist and his companions suffered the tortures of slow starvation for 3 months. At last they got so wild with hunger that lots were cast who should walk up to the master after supper that evening and ask for more. And it fell to Oliver Twist. The evening arrived. The master, in his cook's uniform, stationed himself at the copper. His pauper assistants ranged themselves behind him. The gruel was served out, and a long grace was said over the short commons. The gruel disappeared. The boys whispered to each other and winked at Oliver, while his next neighbours nudged him. Child as he was desperate with hunger and reckless with misery. He rose from the table and, advancing to the master, basin and spoon in hand, said, somewhat alarmed at his own temerity, "Please, sir, I want some more." The master was a fat, healthy man, but he turned very pale. He gazed in stupefied astonishment at the small rebel for some seconds. Then he aimed a blow at Oliver's head with the ladle, pinioned him in his arms, and shrieked aloud for the beadle. The board were sitting in solemn conclave when Mr. Bumble rushed into the room in great excitement and addressed the gentleman in the high chair. "Mr. Limpkins, I beg your pardon, sir. Oliver Twist has asked for more." Horror was depicted on every countenance. "That boy will be hung," said Mr. Limpkins. "I know that boy will be hung." Nobody dissented. Oliver was ordered into instant confinement, and a bill was next morning pasted on the outside of the gate, offering a reward of £5 to anybody who would take Oliver Twist off the hands of the parish. The first taker was Mr. Sowerberry, the parochial undertaker. And so Oliver Twist was apprenticed to the undertaker's trade. In his first few weeks, Oliver did well. His greatest burden was Mr. Sowerberry's assistant, a boy named Noah Claypole, who took every opportunity to ill-treat Oliver. Charlotte, the Sowerberry's daughter, had a soft spot for Noah. She treated Oliver ill because Noah did. Mrs. Sowerberry was his decided enemy because Mr. Sowerberry was disposed to be his friend. One day, Oliver and Noah had descended together into the kitchen to dine on a small joint of mutton. Noah Claypole considered he couldn't possibly devote the occasion to a worthier purpose than tantalising young Oliver Twist. "Workers," said Noah, "how's your mother?" "She's dead," replied Oliver, "and don't you say anything about her to me." "Don't be impudent," said Noah. "Your mother too. A regular right-down bad 'un. It's better she died when she did, or else she'd have been hard labouring in prison, or transported, or hung." Crimson with fury, Oliver started up, seized Noah by the throat and shook him till his teeth chattered in his head. Then, collecting his whole force into one heavy blow, Oliver felled him to the ground. "Help!" shouted Noah. "Charlotte, missus, here's the new boy a-murdering of me. Help! Oliver's gone mad!" There was a loud scream from Charlotte, and a louder one still from Mrs. Sowerberry as they rushed into the kitchen. "You little wretch!" screamed Charlotte, seizing Oliver with her utmost force. "You ungrateful, murderous, horrid villain!" Between every syllable, Charlotte gave Oliver a blow with all her might. Mrs. Sowerberry assisted by holding him with one hand while she scratched his face with the other. In these favourable circumstances, Noah rose from the ground and pummeled him from behind. When they could tear and beat no longer, they dragged Oliver, struggling and shouting, into the cellar and there locked him up. It was at this juncture that Mr. Sowerberry returned. Oliver's offence having been explained to him, he unlocked the cellar door and dragged his rebellious apprentice out by the collar. "Now you're a nice young fellow, ain't you?" said Sowerberry, giving Oliver a shake and a box on the ear. "Who call my mother names?" said Oliver. "Well," said Mrs. Sowerberry, "and what if he did, you ungrateful little wretch? She deserved what he said and worse." "That's a lie," said Oliver. Mrs. Sowerberry burst into a flood of tears. This flood of tears left Mr. Sowerberry no alternative. If he'd hesitated for one instant to punish Oliver most severely, he'd have been labelled an unnatural husband, a brute, and an imitation of a man. So he at once gave Oliver a drubbing which satisfied even Mrs. Sowerberry. Oliver was ordered to bed. It wasn't until he was alone among the coffins, in the silence of the undertaker's workshop, which is where he slept, that he gave way. Now, when there were none to see him, he fell on his knees and, hiding his face in his hands, wept bitterly. Finally, he stood up. He tied up in a handkerchief the few articles of wearing apparel he had, a crust of bread and one penny, and sat himself down upon a bench to wait for morning. With the first ray of light that struggled through the crevices in the shutters, Oliver arose and unbarred the door. Walking quickly, he crossed open fields and eventually gained the high road to London. Walking all day and sleeping in the open, Oliver would most assuredly have fallen dead upon the King's Highway if it hadn't been for a good-hearted turnpike man and a benevolent old lady. The turnpike man gave him a meal of bread and cheese, and the old lady, taking pity on the poor orphan, gave him what little she could afford. Early on the seventh morning, Oliver limped slowly into the little town of Barnet and sat with bleeding feet and covered with dust upon a cold doorstep. He'd been crouching on the step for some time when a boy, who'd passed him carelessly some minutes before, returned. Walking close up to Oliver, he said, "Hello, McCovey, what's the row?" Snub-nosed and common-faced, the boy had about him all the airs and manners of a man. In reply to the question, Oliver said, "I'm very hungry and tired. I've walked a long way. I've been walking these 7 days."
"Walking for 7 days?" said the young gentleman. "You want grub and you shall have it. Up with you on your pins."
He took him to a store and bought bread and ham. As they ate, Oliver learned that his new friend was called Jack Dawkins, though among his intimate friends he was better known as the Artful Dodger.
"I've got to be in London tonight," said Jack, "and I know a respectable old gentleman as lives there, or he'll give you lodgings for nothing and never ask for the change."
It was midnight when they entered a narrow, muddy street. Oliver's companion pushed open the door of a house and, drawing him into the passage, closed it behind them. Oliver, his hand firmly grasped by his companion, ascended the dark and broken stairs. The Dodger threw open the door of a back room. Before a fire stood a deal table upon which was a candle. Seated round the table were 4 or 5 boys. Standing by the fire was a shrivelled and villainous-looking old man.
"Fagin," said Jack Dawkins, "meet my friend Oliver Twist."
The old man took Oliver by the hand.
"Welcome, my dear. My name's Fagin. I dare say you haven't seen the likes of me before."
"No, sir," said Oliver.
"Well, my dear, I hope I shall have the honour of your intimate acquaintance. We're all very glad to see you, Oliver, very."
And the young gentleman crowded round and shook Oliver heartily by the hand. Then they all settled down to supper. Oliver ate his share, and afterwards Fagin mixed him a glass of hot gin and water and told him to drink it down quickly. Oliver did as requested, and immediately afterwards felt himself gently lifted onto one of the sacks that lay around the walls. There he sank into a deep sleep.